Welcome to the Holy Sh** Podcast. Frank and Patsy get together to discuss the issues of the moment. You know, the things that make you say, holy sh**. Here are your hosts, Master Hapkidoist, Patsy Zarilla, and Attorney Frank Natel, Esquire.
I have not even begun to fight.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Holy Shit for Wednesday, December 11th, 2019. I am your co-host, Patsy Zarilla.
And I'm co-host Frank Natel.
And Frank, number 52, our one-year anniversary. It's like we're married.
Yeah. I mean, we're officially a couple now, I guess, right?
I guess so. What is it? Papers? Paper to 1 year?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know. Whatever it is. Everybody, I'm so excited to have a panel with us today that are some of my favorite people in the whole world. And all of you have heard us discuss, whether you heard everybody on this podcast or on the Mastering the News podcast with myself and Master Grant. And so I'd like to do an introduction right away for everybody, and I might as well start off with my dear friend and instructor and my co-host for the Mastering the News podcast, my dear friend Grant Miller. How are you doing today, sir?
I am doing wonderful, thank you. Thank you from London, England.
See that? We're keeping him up past his bedtime to be honest with us today. So, you know. And with us, two people I'm so proud to have on with us. You guys have heard Dr. Dai on this podcast and on the Mastering the News podcast. So our first guest, or well, not first guest, but just in the order, Dr. Diane Bowser is with us. How are you, Dr. Dai?
I'm doing awesome. Hi, Patsy and Frank, and congratulations on your 100th show.
Thank you, Dr. Dai.
Thank you. And of course, our dear friend and the owner of Ramsey Law, Phyllis Ramsey. I'm sorry, Phil. And I guess
for me in 2020, I will not be Philip in 2020, but hey.
How are you, Phil?
Never know. I am great. How are you all?
We are thrilled. This is a big deal for me. It really is. This thing started a year ago. Actually, it started more than a year ago. And Master Grant has a great way of telling the story of how this whole thing started. So why don't I just sit back and everybody and just let Master Grant tell the story of how this podcast got started.
So it all started. We were at the Hapkido Summit in New Jersey, where Dojinim Jihan Jay from Game of Death, from the Bruce Lee movie Game of Death. He's the one in the second to last octagon, who is one of our instructors, who we were there at the summit, and we were on our way home. And just to kind of put it a bit mildly, Master Zarilla, he tends to look at speed limits in terms of kilometers. And so as we were doing 120 kilometers, we were talking, and as we were talking about various subjects and various views and political views and all these things, one of us, I don't know who, but one of us said, you know, we ought to make a show out of this because it was very interesting. It passed the time. So from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh, it took us a total of about 3 hours to get back. And so if you're not from the area, Google the distance between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and you'll see how fast Master Zarilla was going. And we decided that because we had such a great conversation, that maybe we ought to make a podcast and a show out of it. And
that's how Lessons from the Dojang started.
And that's where we are.
Yep. That's how our Lessons from the Dojang podcast started, and then it morphed into this whenever Master Grant and I went out and started doing the Mastering the News podcast. Don't listen to him. I measure everything in per hour. I just look at speed limits as challenges. That's all. But anyhow, that's how this whole thing started. It was done just simply on a drive home one day, you know, or one night, just, you know, after what, 8 hours on a mat, pretty much getting thrown around, sore, tired. We jump in a car from Voorhees, New Jersey, and right after we got on the other side of Philly, we started talking about this, and next thing you know, we started it off, and here we are today. So funny how things happen. We were just driving around, and it's almost like we knew where we were going the whole time. Speaking of knowing where things are going, this past Tuesday, the Democrats in the House had a presser where they unveiled the two articles of impeachment that they are going to vote on against the president. The two charges are abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. And this, if he is impeached, he will only be the third U.S. president in what, 200 and almost 260 years. Before we start getting our thoughts, Frank or Phil, would you like to kind of explain to everybody what exactly happens during what exactly impeachment is?
He's in the doghouse.
He done fucked up.
What had happened was he did some, well, he allegedly did some stuff. He allegedly did some stuff. But it's basically when the legislative body brings charges against a government official. I've heard some people say recently, oh, they're going to impeach him, so he's going to get fired or taken out of office tomorrow. So it won't be that simple, for good and for bad. You know, I believe in democracy, so I do believe that everybody deserves due process and that we should have a set system. But it basically means that he's been charged with certain things. It's not a criminal trial, so they can't put him in jail. I can't say he will never go to jail. One can hope. But basically, if you had to use an analogy, it would be similar to an indictment. So, you know, when you get indicted, nobody speak up if you've been indicted before. Let's just keep it quiet. But when someone is indicted in a criminal trial or a criminal matter, it just means that a grand jury in that case gets together and said, hey, there's enough evidence to suggest that this person has committed a crime, and then we'll take it on you in a criminal trial. It usually goes on to court, to a jury or judge. So the impeachment process is basically where the legislative body just gets together and says, hey, there's enough evidence to suggest that he's committed these wrongs. We are bringing these charges against him, and it goes from there. So what a roller coaster.
Basically what is happening is it safe to say, I should ask you this, is it safe to say that this impeachment process that's happening in the House, assuming the majority votes to impeach, does this basically mean then that there's now enough evidence to trial? And again, I'm being in trying to keep it as simple as possible, and that trial actually happens in the Senate.
Well, it suggests that he's been accused of, I will not use the word, that the phrase that there's enough evidence. You know, we have this saying in talking about criminal law that a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. So it just suggests that there is, that those who vote on impeachment think there is enough to at least charge him with certain missteps.
Okay. So the actual charging will be the vote for impeachment.
Right.
Okay. All right. Just, you know, so people understand. We all saw the hearings. I'm just going to throw it out to the entire panel. What were your thoughts on the on everything from the process to the people that they had testify to what these people said? What was your feelings about all of this? anybody. I'm just throwing it out for
no surprises. I mean, look at what we've gone endured for the last few years. So no surprises. I think it's a circus. I think it's going to be a circus from whatever angle. I think like we've done for the last, what now? I can't even remember the number of years now. Maybe I've tried to forget, but for the last 3 years, we get our popcorn, we sit back, I get my whiskey, and we see what's going on next. I don't think we can, unlike any other time in history, any other impeachment, I don't think we can even imagine what to expect. I every day I wake up, I mean, I'm almost sad to go to sleep at night because I am always like something is going to happen and I'm going to miss it happening live. So I think we're in for a roller coaster ride, for some surprises, for some good history to be made, and some for some good law to be made.
That's awesome. I love the way Adam Schiff summarized everything for the American people at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day. I thought that was so important to not let things go off the rails and to tell a story. But right now, I wish the Democrats would stay on messaging about the findings of those hearings and the necessity for this trial.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. That's the one thing the Republicans do very well is they really stay on message well. The Democrats seem to be kind of all over the place from one minute to the next, though. Did anybody else notice how it seems like the Republican side did more complaining about the process than they actually did or tried to dig into any of the problems that were presented?
Does anyone think they're...
I mean, as you said, they are... If I was given hand claps, which I will not do, but they are keeping it on message. You know, they are back in their boy. They are keeping this thing on message. They are back in their boy. They are attacking the process. And I would say it was subliminal seduction, but it's not subliminal at all.
No, Sorry about that. I had music. Spontaneous music in my life. I agree. There's no surprises. There's nothing new. But I don't think they had any viable defense, right? There was no viable defense. So all they could do was make chaos. And I'm afraid the same thing is going to happen in the Senate trial.
Master Grant?
Okay. So I've been here in London for a number of weeks now, and I get most of my news from the Times. And quite frankly, what the news here is stating is that the one house, the Democratic Congress, is going to push forward their impeachment, which will be then counteracted by the Republicans, who will deny, and then we'll have an absolute stalemate. And one of the questions that I can't seem to quite get my hands around an answer is that how is it that criminal charges are pretty much are there that he used his power to try to gather information about a political rival. I don't think there's any question about that. It's pretty well in proof, but yet because your political party owns a house, they can absolutely undermine the rule of law and state that this is all a witch hunt or politically motivated, and then wash it away. I quite frankly feel that if it was me, I'd be thrown in jail and the key would be locked away. So why do we see this? And it's like for me, it's kind of. I can't seem to fathom how rule of law is trumped, and sorry to say that, but how the rule of law is trumped by your party, which is the Republicans.
Because absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think that's what we have seen here. I wish I had that much power, as you said.
So are you saying that our country, which is based on laws, is no longer valid? So if you're a political party, as the rule of the houses in the presidency, that you can basically do what you want?
I'm a Black woman, and I'm a Black woman attorney. And it may seem oxymoronic or ironic. I have very little faith that the laws operate the way that they are supposed to. I think one thing is really surprising many people is that they are finding out what those of us who are marginalized in this country found out a long time ago, is that those who are in power will make the laws operate according to the way that they want them to operate. So, you know, I have so many liberal friends who are sitting back and shocked and, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe they're letting them get away with this. And I'm always like, but where was that same energy before? I've said this about this election all along. People are acting so surprised that he won. I'm even going back to the election that he won. None of us who have been marginalized, none of us who this law has been used to, the laws of this country have always been used to marginalize certain people, to strip power from certain people and to maintain the status quo. So I'm not saying that this country is a country with no laws, but I do think it is a country that the laws only apply to certain people. And at this point in time, he happens to be in that privileged group of people who are manipulating the laws.
That's a great point. And so, Frank, I would like to hear your take as a lawyer, as well as, you know, you're both lawyers, I understand. But as a lawyer, how do you feel about this?
Ooh. And we lost Frank.
No.
Well,
just get scared.
I'm not arguing.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
There we go.
Okay. No, so, you know, I agree with Phyllis. I mean, I'm frustrated by this because, you know, you want to see things done right. And while it's not a surprise to me because, you know, I didn't grow up a person of color, you know, I have direct family members that are, and I've seen it happen to them. I've witnessed it in I guess, a secondhand nature. But you know, and also from my work, I've been very close to it from my work for the last 7 years from, you know, even during the Obama era, you know, I think Phyllis and I used to have this discussion that there were times where we were frustrated with political inaction to help, you know, disenfranchised and people of that are disenfranchised to succeed. We saw some things that were wrong during that era, and it was hard to even, you know, work to call that out. Because, you know, the people that are disenfranchised have very little power, have very little voice. But now, you know, more people are directly affected by this and directly see how power can corrupt and money can corrupt. And it's very frustrating. I wish that we could have change. I really think that, in my opinion, the only way that we will affect change is to take a lesson from maybe past generations that have marched on Washington, D.C., like in the Vietnam era, and also from people around the world who have marched upon their capitals to affect change. Because the only way those people that are in power will change is if they're afraid, quite frankly. And if they see masses of people outside their office, you know, threatening protest and threatening to shut things down, that may bring them to account.
Yeah, it always seems to do that. You know, that's a
wonderful point. And you know, when you listen to things that are happening, you would think that, this is a great travesty. It's a gross, gross abuse of power. How can our so-called democracy and rule of law be so? But then, of course, if you control the message, you control what people think. So if, I'm a software engineer, and so engineer, Master Patsy. Build things and develop things and configure things, there's a message. And my message could be, we're on track, everything's good, we're going to make it. Or my message could be, holy crap, this all sucks. We're gonna be flushed down the toilet. And so when you are when you have a system in place that controls the messaging, then you can keep you message enough that even the people that are affected negatively by these things start to believe in what they're hearing, and they start drinking the Kool-Aid. And I wanted to see what your thoughts were, and that's everybody, what your thoughts are on who's controlling the messaging, and how is it that Mitch McConnell can stand up there and say, oh, well, this is a witch hunt, and get away with it.
Well, he can stand up there and do that because he's the guy in power right now. That's why. It's as simple as that. Who does Mitch McConnell answer to? Nobody. So he can do whatever he wants.
Also, the media is owned. The consolidation in the media over the last 30 years has brought us from something like 493 media companies in 1990 to 6 media companies today. And all of them are corporate owned. All of them are controlled by people who have an interest in preserving the status quo. And they air Mitch McConnell's message way more than they're going to air a message from somebody like AOC. So, I mean, this is the imbalance that we're dealing with. There is no truly free, unbiased media. This media is biased in the direction of the plutocrats.
Yeah, absolutely. Phil made a point about how people sat there and said, I'm kind of paraphrasing a little bit, how people are saying, basically they're saying, holy crap, how can you get away with this? It's the only thing that went through my mind is it's amazing what happens whenever the privilege that you've been able to enjoy for so long comes back and shows its ugly face to you, and you don't realize what you're looking at.
Absolutely. I would challenge anybody who's disgusted with what's going on now or who has asked the question, how could this happen? I would challenge them that if you want to see real change, are you ready to give up your privilege and your power?
Yeah.
Because there are so many people who can see what's wrong with this. I was having this talk with a group of coworkers the other day. We were talking in reference to the police woman who killed the innocent man in his own home in Dallas. But we were having this talk, and I made the point that I was in a group, and I was the only person of color. Imagine that. I'm always the only person of color. But we had a meeting, and I was saying at the end of the meeting, oh, I need to call my neighbors and let them know that my front door lock is broken so that I will be going around to the back of my house, climbing up the balcony and going in through the back sliding door. I had on all black that day. And my coworkers are, oh, there's no need to call. There's no, nothing will happen. And I was like, bullshit. And I challenged them, hey, you have to give up your privilege. You have to step aside from what you know. You have to step aside from the life that you live. And in order to impact change, are you willing to give up that privilege? What I challenged the colleagues that I was meeting with the other day, are you willing the next time you go home and see somebody, quote unquote, suspicious, are you willing to give up your privilege and say, I'm not calling the police? Granted, no. Somebody's house may get robbed, but on the other hand, an innocent person may get killed. So I challenge everybody who has privilege, who has power, and who is disturbed, disgusted, saddened, frustrated, emotionally distressed by what's going on. If you want true change, are you willing to give up, your privilege if and when this ever blows over? And I think that's a hard question that we all have to ask ourselves. We're only seeing it in an exaggerated version now, but what we're seeing now happens each and every day. What we're seeing now, the abuse of power, the manipulation of the media happens each and every day. So if you sign the petition against Mike Vick, but then on the other hand, you're acting so upset about the impeachment, you're a fucking fraud.
Yeah, Phil, you and Frank are in a group in a conversation right now with three martial artists, and Frank is on his way to being a martial artist. And I promise you, the one thing all three of us have said on the floor at any given time is you always see the world as you are. You never see the world for what it is.
Yeah.
And it's funny how whenever people who didn't realize that they were benefiting from a certain, I don't want to say status, but a certain, well, let's say status. You'll understand what I mean. Whenever that is shaken, or whenever that is, I don't want to say thrown up in their face, because that's implying a conflict, and that's not what I mean. But it's shown that, hey, the world isn't really like how you thought it was, or the world isn't really like what it is in your community. That a lot of times people don't know how to handle that. And you made a good point. Are you willing to give up? What are you willing to give up in order to make this right? You know, signing a petition, anybody could do that, especially online, where you don't even have to get a name or anything, right? You can hide behind that screen and no one has to know who you are. But are you willing to go out on that street and make that march and have people see your face and have people, you know, be willing to have people throw things at you and to call you everything but human? Are you willing to do that? That tells a lot about the character of the person too, though.
Let
me jump in real quick. I want to give a quick anecdote about how hard it is to give up privilege. And it's not so much about race as it is about maybe class and education and earnings, I guess, is one of the ways to put it. I was in a very, very good nonprofit organization that was, you know, I've talked about it on this podcast mm-hmm. before, that I'm very proud to have been part of. And it's one of the high points of my career. But I would say this, we had a human rights, we had a very strong human rights philosophy. It was part of our reason for being. And we were one of the first two in the country to adopt this human rights philosophy, that we were going to live it. I mean, every day live it in every way with everybody that we worked with and everybody that we came into contact with. And what it did was it caused a struggle amongst the power structure within our own organization to understand what that truly meant, to give up the privilege that we had, because it was so cognitive dissonance amongst the, you know, the executives and the people that had maybe higher degrees or higher titles, to say that we were going to give over power to the secretaries, to the janitors, to the folks who didn't have the advanced degrees, and to give them a say. And, you know, there was a struggle in the sense of saying, well, you know, what are you going to say? They can come in when they want to, that they can do the type of work that they want to, that they can refuse to type when you're asking them to transcribe something. And, you know, that's not necessarily what it's about, but it is about giving people autonomy and giving people a right to have a voice at the workplace. And if they, you know, if they are truly equal and we have human rights amongst each other, and we're respectful of every human being that walks in that door, then sometimes it might mean that, you know, and it's a big struggle to step back and say, I'm going to give that power up. And even amongst an organization that was truly committed to that in word and in deed, sometimes, maybe oftentimes, failed to meet it. And I would ask, you know, everybody to think about that. If you own a workplace, if you own a business, would you be willing to step inside that business and say, I'm going to step back and give other people a voice here, to the extent that they make decisions? You know, it's tough to do. It really is. But
it really is tough to do, because first you have to see your privilege, and so much privilege is immutable that it's, you don't even know that you have it. You know, I will admit I am very privileged in so many ways, but as I said, I am a Black woman. So when I get pulled over, it usually comes out 20 minutes into the stop that I'm an attorney. But when they just pull me over, it is not immediately there. I had this incident the other day. I got sick and I was out of town. So I went to an urgent care center, and oh, the difference when they found out I had Blue Cross Blue Shield. And it took them about 30 minutes to find out that I had Blue Cross Blue Shield. And not only that, a doctor came from the back, and I happened to know the doctor. I actually used to represent the doctor. My treatment plan changed on the spot. And there was no way when I walked in that they knew that this Black girl in sweats, who was just in pain and just wanted to be cured, they did not know that I was a business owner. They did not know that I was an attorney. And so a lot of privilege is so immutable that you get it without even trying to get it. You know, mm-hmm. Look at the way we describe people. Look at the way that we treat people. Look at the way when we see people walking down the street, how we make certain assumptions about them. And I think for anybody to even give up power, you first have to even admit you have power. And I think the problem with privilege is that so many people don't even know that they have it. They don't know. I mean, I have so many, God bless you, to my white friends. But if one more white friend says to me, when you get pulled over, why don't you just ask for the badge number? Because I'm trying to live, you know? Yeah. I don't want you to call my mom and says, and when she asks for the badge number, that's when they put one in her skull. I'm trying to live. Or when my white friends say, but that's just wrong. You should do something about it. I'm first and foremost trying to survive, because if I survive, maybe I can be a small change in the world. And I see it too. You know, I was just telling somebody that I'm for the legalization of marijuana. If you all didn't know, we need to have a whole show on that, by the way. But I'm for the legalization of marijuana, and I was telling somebody how I'm for the legalization of it, and that I think all of these things about it. And they said to me, but you can say that publicly because you own your own business and you're an attorney, and you can say that publicly on a podcast or on a news show, and you don't worry that night that someone's going to come to your house and make up a reason to search it. And you don't worry that when you pull out of the radio station or when you pull out of the interview where you talk about your support of the legalization of marijuana, that they are going to try to pull you over and maybe try to find a joint or try to find a brownie in the car. And so I think we all have to realize that we do have it. Even watching these impeachment hearings, we have to all realize that we're all watching it from a different lens. I'm watching it from the lens of, this dude is not going to get taken down because white men never get taken down. So that's the lens I'm watching it from. Some of you are probably watching it from the lens as I believe in truth and justice, and I cannot believe this is happening. I haven't lived a life where truth and justice has been on my side. So that's not the lens I'm watching it from. In fact, usually when I'm watching it, I have the TV on mute and a drink in my hand because I know how the story's going to end.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Frank and I are in the mob, so it doesn't matter.
Well, I knew that.
I think I'm with you.
Yeah, die too, right?
There's a good, Phyllis makes a great point. If you've never lived outside of a country where you're not the majority, you'll never understand what the fear is like when you are a minority in a country and you are put into a situation that is very bad. And just based on the color of your skin, things are, assumptions are made. And from those assumptions come many horrible things. And so you react in a way that basically assures that you are not a threat, that you want to survive. And for people who've never ever experienced anything like that, it's hard to put into words what it's like to be there, and the fear and the adrenaline that flows through, and we think about our country, and we think about what a great, wonderful place it is, but at the same time, we ignore our past, and we ignore injustices, and things aren't looked at through an equal lens. And you know, when we look at it, and Phyllis said it perfectly, you'll see many white people look at the president's impeachment and say that it's basically a witch hunt by socialists who just won him out because they are afraid, they lost the election. But look at it the other side. Put yourself in the shoes of the other side, and look at, you know, what was Mitch McConnell and Master Patsy, I'm going to ask you this because you know the answer. What was it? What was the first thing that he said when he was elected?
We are going to make a Barack Obama a one-term president.
Exactly. Now, having said that, okay, and I hope that our listeners who are listening really comprehend those words and what they meant and what they mean, because this is a direct white supremacist coming to restore the order that they believe it should be. And that's exactly what they've done with gerrymandering, with Fox News. So you control the media, you control the propaganda, you control the masses. And I'm not going to be ashamed to say that when most of our country has little more than a middle school education, I was going to say high school, sorry, I went Dr. D, I went too far. When most of our country has no more than a middle school education, and Lord knows, Master Patsy, we know people that can hardly read, that you put a book in front of them, they can hardly read. And yet they are people who would gather up their family, stuff them in a car and take them to vote for President Trump. And
yep,
there's a huge, and we're blind. We just are so blind to this. And that to me is the scariest thing. I brought up this whole media thing so that we could talk about it, because the media paints the picture, they spread the message, and by the person who owns the message is the person who owns how the masses are controlled. And Fox News, and I know how they love to say liberal media, liberal, that is so ironic. They're the ones who control everything, because you go and ask any, and this is the best part, any union card-carrying member, what do they listen between 9 and 5 p.m.? And it's going to be Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh. And these are union members, okay?
That's sickening.
It is. And you know, I know union guys, and I say to them, how can you even say you're in a union if you listen to this crap? And they all go, well, you know, Rush Limbaugh says. And then it's just, they just regurgitate what they heard that afternoon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the media point is such a good point. I think a lot of times when we talk about the power of the media, people think we're talking about putting on a million shows about one thing, and we are talking about that. But the media can really slip up on you. I mean, imaging is everything. And I think one thing that the Republican Party, I don't want to use the word, has done well, because so one thing, as we mentioned before, they have stayed consistent. They have short, consistent messages, and it gets into the brains of people. So in this last election, as you mentioned about the education level of so many people that voted, nobody gave these voters 50-page, you know, pamphlets. They just said little subliminal things, make America great again. What a simple message. But we all know that it's loaded. And I think we haven't.
That's loaded.
That is so loaded, but it's, look at how simple, and I mean, make America great again, four words, but look at how loaded that message is. And I think one thing we don't realize with the power of the media is that there are these little things that you don't even know are in your psyche until it's either too late or until you think like that. You know, I was in Ghana last year, and one of the things that I found fascinating is that, you know, I left the States and going through bullshit, you know, I'm a Black woman flying in first class, so that was already a situation. But, you know, side note, my ancestors came here on the ship. I went back over there first class. But anyway, I had been in Ghana. I stayed there a month. I had been there about a week. And I kept saying, something is different when I wake up in the morning. And of course, it's different. I'm halfway across the world. The weather is different. But I realized that every ad I saw was Black people. So I didn't turn on the TV and see these L'Oreal ads and Maybelline ads with white women with long flowing hair and blue eyes. And when we would walk down the street, the billboards were Black people. And, you know, on the radio, you turn on the radio and it was Black people talking. And I realized that that got into my psyche. And every time we went somewhere, they thought I was Ghanaian. And so in Ghana, at a lot of the museums, if you're Ghanaian, you pay a cheaper price to get in. So I would stand in line for foreigners, and they would always pull me out of line and say, oh no, you're home, come through this line. But and I never woke up every morning and said I woke up happy this morning, because last night the last thing I saw was a billboard with a Black woman on it. But it got into my psyche, and that changed me even in just a month. And I think about, if we're seeing it over and over again, if you're watching Fox News over and over again during the election cycle, if all you heard was Make America Great Again, and we all know what that meant, but if you just hear that over and over, it gets into your psyche and you don't even realize the power that it has over you. And so then, what, 3 years later, when somebody stands up and says, this is a witch hunt, you say, well, yeah, it is, because we were just trying to make America great again and they want to stop that. And so I think we have to realize the power of the media. You know, we watch what we put in our bodies. So many of us, especially me over 40, I watch what I put in my body because it's not as forgiving anymore. But we don't watch what we put it into our heads. And I think that is so important as we talk about what this nation believes, what we believe about the world. I mean, most of the information that we have on each other, we get it from somewhere else in the world. So I didn't learn about white people because I do have them in my family, actually a lot of them, but that was actually not my first knowledge of white people. My first knowledge of white people was what I saw in the media. Right. You know, I learned about white people by watching Roots. I learned about white people by watching Good Times and seeing what the Evans family thought about white people. So I think we all have to accept that all of us are somehow influenced by it. And the party that's in control will be the party that controls the messaging.
That's true. That's so true. I want to go back to something Master Grant said about Americans having education. Master Grant, Master Passy, I think you guys are optimists, right? Some of the studies that have come out in the last 10 years show that compared to their international counterparts, so Grant, the people you might encounter in London, Americans have a third or fourth grade education, depending on how you stack it up. So that simple messaging, to dovetail on Phyllis's point, that simple messaging is like perfect food. I mean, Yes We Can was a simple message too. And again, we Democrats or liberals have not done a really good job of simple messaging throughout this entire Trump's investigation, right? I mean, simpler messaging would have focused on treason. Simpler message would have focused on bribery and extortion in the keywords, you know? And we get all techno about it and want to talk about it on an intellectual level. And most Americans, after two sentences, tune out, and they're gone.
Yeah, the problem we have with that, though, I think, and I'm by no means stating it as fact as much as it is my opinion, is because the more liberal side, I don't want to say the Democrat side because I'm an independent, tends to be more diverse. And so you're going to see different points of view. So it's hard to get on a simple message that we can all say we're on the other side, right? There, it's all Wonder Bread, right? So it's pretty easy to sit there and make a statement or a four-word little, you know, catchphrase that everybody can jump on and everybody can say, because, you know, you have one tribe on one end and like the whole rest of the island with all the other tribes on the other end.
And I get it, but no lawless president is three words too. You know, I mean, like we have to come up with something.
Yes. No, you're right. You're right. And I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just trying to explain why I think it's what it is. But yeah, you're right. Well, Obama did it right with Yes We Can. There's three
Yes
words
We Can.
That everybody jumped on and everybody understood, and everybody understood the messaging behind that. Right.
Right.
It was brilliant. It was uplifting. It was you know, something that was trying to bring people together. And you know, it's, you know, yes, we can. And the key word there is the middle word is we, right? Where whenever we're talking about make America great again, that's going back and it's talking about a very singular, specific point of view
that never really happened. You know, I mean, well,
it served the purpose, though. It got him in the White House.
Right. I would liken this to Germany in the 1930s when Hitler had Leni Riefenstahl film A Triumph of the Will. Right. Mm-hmm. And so she films this movie and it plays in all the German theaters and it makes the Nazi Party. It literally makes the Hitler Youth and the Nazi Party the central figure of. Geez, I'm popular today. Sorry. It makes sort of the Nazi Party the central political party in Germany, right? Because it's propaganda, it's well done, as were the 1936 Olympics, right? And that propaganda sort of formed the background mythology for all of the Nazi rise to power. And I would submit that things like Fox News and this Make America Great Again and this sort of cult of meanness that they've cultivated around that is just like parallel to that situation, right? And so we've got to counter it with another simple slogan. I know it sounds horrible to say that, but I think that's the case.
I think that's true because I think a lot of the reason that those of us who believe in social justice and just justice in general, the reason we are not being successful is because even though it's true, the only language we have to describe this is so rough. So people never want to listen when I tell them, hey, you know you're racist. You know that's white supremacy. Because it's such a bad word and nobody wants to, you know, so we say things like microaggressions and I don't even know what the hell a microaggression is. But
how many microaggressions make a maximal aggression? I mean, I don't know.
But it's so nice and pretty and wrapped in a bow. You know, when I just tell people, oh no, that was just racist. But still, if I have a black friend, or you know, that's white supremacy. You know, people will say nobody's in the Klan. I didn't say you were in the Klan. I said that's white supremacist thinking. And so I think we have got to develop a message that will be accepted, that will not scare people off, but that also tells the truth at the same time. You know, we have to do that because until we do, the urgency is not seen. The only language I have right now is that's white supremacy. That's racist. But people are turned off. Even the liberals are turned off from that because they, you know, that's just so harsh, Phyllis. Why are you saying it like that? But it's the truth. And so when we develop that message, maybe we too, or I'm saying we may, maybe those that they too, maybe I shouldn't say we, but they too can be, in it. I had a colleague tell me, a colleague who does social justice, by the way, said, you need to pull back on posting so much about so many violent things. Because I'm always posting about the cops killed a black person today. This black person got hurt today. This black person walked in their house and this black person was sitting in their house and was killed. And my colleague says, you need to pull back from the violence. That's so violent. But life is violent. Especially for my people.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you know what? That's a good point. I mean, you know, folks, you know, in our conversation and folks listening, and basically anybody who knows me knows I'm pretty blunt and pretty foul-mouthed about, well, just about everything. And I think the problem that we have, and Phil, I think you were spot on, was that we're not the truths we're talking about are ugly truths. And they're ugly truths that maybe people don't want to see, or if they see it, they don't want to admit it.
Exactly.
And it's very difficult to point that out or expose that or whatever the case may be, use any word you want to use, without them being defensive or without them. Thank you. Or, you know, folks, just, I'm sorry, but these automated Alexa things, sometimes they go off on their own. Okay.
Big brother is in your house.
Yeah. You know what? You better get the hell out of But I think it's because it is so ugly and people get so defensive or they want to go the other way where they're not defensive. They just don't want to appear as though maybe they are, that they get it's very difficult to talk about these subjects or to put it in concepts or conceptually the way people can understand without them feeling.
Nobody wants to look in the mirror and see what's looking back at them. And
especially if it's ugly.
Admitting white supremacy is running rampant in our country is not an easy thing to do and not an easy thing to to admit. But once you do, it's liberating because now you can see. And when you can see, now you can make change. There is no question in my mind at all that what we're seeing is a complete corrupt grasp of power to bring us back to the 18th century. And people legitimize this because of a lack of pigmentation in their skin. You know, 99.9995% of all of us are unique, are the same. And that little percentage, because you have lack of pigmentation, which actually, if you think about it, is something that you don't want to boast about, because a lack of pigmentation means a weakness. But, you have a lack of pigmentation in your skin, doesn't make you superior to anyone. In fact, if you look at it, white people, all white people, are nothing more, and the Japanese have pegged us perfectly. We are nothing more than polluted blood. Oh, I'm Croatian. Oh, whatever, right? No, you're not. You're a mutt. You're a mutt of inbred, polluted blood, just like the Japanese say we are. And when you think about that, you think about how, and I'm sorry, I'm just all fired up, but you realize that there is human beings are human beings. And the moment that we can stop looking at a person's exterior and look at a person's heart and what they have inside is the moment that our entire world, our entire civilization will finally take the step out of the dark ages and finally into an enlightened age.
Do you think it'll ever happen?
It's going to be a minute.
I believe it. I believe it will. Maybe not in our lifetime, but eventually will.
You think?
I hope.
I am. Well, there's hope, and then there's a lot of things I hope for.
I think we made some progress. I mean, look at your great grandparents' generation. Look at how things were, right? Mm-hmm. And they aren't that way anymore. You know, I mean, every time we take two steps forward, we might take one step back. But now if somebody came and said, well, we shouldn't have interracial marriage anymore. We shouldn't have birth control anymore. Like, and the Republicans do that one all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And they get shut down.
What happens when you breed dogs and you inbreed dogs too many times? What happens? Right. So you're going against science. You're going against Darwinism. You're going against basic instinct, which is, you seek out new genes. It's basic stuff. And it's things that we feel that just because the royal family has been inbred for like 17 generations, we feel that that's great. Well, needless to say, they got oval heads and they look like, Deliverance. That, we got West Virginia. And we got West Virginia to give up the royal family. So I don't get it. I really don't. It's like that you guys, this thing, this simplistic, moronic, Neanderthal thinking has to be moved aside so that we can at least start to realize that human beings are human beings and one life is all you get. And we need to make everyone's lives as beneficial as we can, so we all can, work towards striving to improve our society, striving to improve everyone's lives and well-being, striving to improve medicine, striving to get rid of pancreatic cancer and breast cancer and all these things that harm us, instead of wasting our time worrying about, you ain't gonna take my guns from me. And
that's just a distraction, right? I mean,
yeah, but it's a damn good one.
Yeah, oh yeah, it is, because it's a fear, right? It preys on fear. But my point here is, like, I think these MAGA, the MAGA movement, if you will, right? I think that's a reaction against the fact that they are becoming obsolete, that we're not going back to the 19th century, that they cannot turn the clock back, and that the next generation is going to be more liberal and more progressive than we are.
Yeah, that's dead spot on. That's dead spot on. You know, it's funny, and we'll go back to. I look at how my son looks at things that happen in society, and Di, yours is probably the same way, and I know Frank's is. where we see something and pick something, I don't give a shit what it is, pick something, anything that whenever we were 18, 19 years old would have been looked at, would have looked down upon, we'll say. And interracial marriage is a great example, right? Where now his generation looks at it like, what's the big deal?
That's my point. That's exactly my point.
What difference does it make?
In three or four generations, we've made tremendous progress. And it's not all perfect. It's not all good. And there's a lot of still really messed up things going on. But I see like those, you know, sort of the neo-Nazis or whatever. I see them as trying to hang, like they realize they're going extinct. This is a reaction to extinction.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that they're going extinct. I think they're coming back in different forms. I think that for many of us who see progress, we see progress within the circles that we are involved with. However, you know, while I'm not in my great grandmother's generations, in so many ways, I'm in a generation that's so much worse than my great grandmother's generation. I definitely don't want to go back to a time where the Klan was putting crosses in front of my family's homes, or a time where I could walk out and be lynched. But we're still doing that now. They've just gotten so high tech with it. They've gotten so, you know, so much more subliminal with it. And so I don't necessarily, I'm definitely not a pessimist. I'm a serial optimist. But I think we have to be very cautious with applauding ourselves for the progress that we have made.
Oh, sure.
I don't think that there's any difference between lynching and what's happening now with police attacks against Black and brown bodies. I don't think that there is any difference now with somebody having to drink out of a water fountain labeled colored, with me having to explain to a fucking flight attendant that yes, I am in first class. I don't think those things are, you know, very far apart. I don't think there is not much difference. Somebody just mentioned, you know, finding cures for pancreatic cancer and breast cancer. I don't think that there's much difference from the Tuskegee experiment with my mother's own story of breast cancer, where she was denied a mammogram when she first went until they found out her daughter was a loud mouth. So I think they are coming in different forms now, but I think we're at a crisis, actually. I mean, again, I'm a serial optimist, but there are so many days that I am thinking we have not made any progress at all. At least they had the courage to tell us at Plessy v. Ferguson is that actually you're not a man or a woman. They don't say those words now, but that's the message that we get. And I think we have to totally dismantle the system. And then again, that's going to take all of us giving up some privilege. But I think that we can't pat ourselves on the back too much for the progress that we have made, because it's not necessarily progress. It's just the same script with a different cast.
Well, I think the only argument I have against that, Phil, and again, you know, we always say we see things how we are, is, well, I'm not by any means denying anything that you've said. I'm just seeing that from our generation or the generations before us. I'm not seeing that as much from the generations after us.
Yeah, I still do.
You do? Okay, yeah. Well, all right. Well,
I'm going to take,
I mean, you would know, I'm just saying, you know.
I want to take it sideways for a second.
And this is not to say that I don't have a good life, because most of my days are extremely good. But again, I'm also talking from my position of privilege. Mm-hmm. So I'm also talking from a perspective, and just because I may not experience something personally, and believe me, I experienced a hell of a lot, but even most of the examples that I give you all, I'm experiencing these things within the midst of my privilege. So I'm giving examples about flying first class and getting discriminated against, but the bottom line is I'm flying first class.
Dig that. I'm back in coach, you
know,
man.
I'm speaking of some of the perspective of some of my clients. I'm speaking from the perspective of some of my family members. I'm speaking from the perspective of those people in the neighborhood who just know me, and all they know about me is that I'm an attorney, but they call me up and say, I just need you to do something, because their lives are so much different from my life. And so I do think we have a generation who has passed down hate, bigotry, and the cancer of oppression to their little ones. And I do hope that those of us who are on the right side of justice will prevail, but I'm not naive enough to turn my back and think, you know, I would rather be cautious than a fool. And I right. think it's from both sides. I mean, it's ingrained. It goes both ways. It's ingrained in me. There are certain things that are ingrained in me. I mean, I can tell the story of how I met Frank. And I was so, I mean, he struck up a we took the bar exam together. And I can remember thinking, I got to walk out with a crowd because this white man may try to touch me or rape me or something. But that was my, you know, that was my view. And it had nothing to do with Frank personally. I didn't care that he too was taking a fucked up bar exam that we should not have had to take. I just was like, this is a white man. He's talking to me. He's appearing to be friendly to me, but what does it mean? What is his game plan? Like what, how does he mean to oppress me in this? Glad I got over that, Frank, because you're one of my besties. But you know, that's just something that we have to deal with because I'm from a generation who learned, thank God I didn't just learn what was in the school, but so I'm from a generation who learned that white men raped black women. And so my whole life, my relationship with white men has been very, very tenuous because I'm not going to unlearn that because in many ways it is true. But I think it has to work both ways. It really has to work both ways. So I don't care if the powers that be even give up their power. If the marginalized and the powerless do not believe you, then there is no progress made. And so, yes, I'm still almost shitting my pants every time I see blue lights behind me. I'm still hesitant when a white man reaches out to hug me. I'm still rolling my eyes when a white woman cries. And I think until we all have seen some progress that progress has actually been made, that no progress has been made.
That's true. I want to take it sideways just for a second and look at rights just as a parallel situation too. Gay marriage would have been unthinkable 30 years, you know, in the sense that you would have 100% of the people saying, well, we don't have 100%. We probably have 80% of the people saying gay marriage is a right. We cannot take it away. You know, 30 years ago, it would probably be exactly flip-flop. Right? 20% of the people would be standing up with signs saying gay marriage is a right. We cannot take it away. And the other 80% would be like, no, that's not a right. So I think I'm cautiously optimistic, but I also see it rolling forward and rolling away from the authoritarians and the fascists. And that's why they're grabbing so hard all over Europe. And they're starting all of these neo-Nazi parties. It is a different form. It uses technology. It's sinister. But it's not holding as much of the population as it used to. That's my only point here. It's not like, oh, we've reached a kumbaya moment together, because I know it's not that.
Oh, no,
I know it's not that.
Definitely. But I'm glad you brought up gay marriage, because even from that perspective, so funny story, when the day the Supreme Court came down with the decision on gay marriage, I happened to be like a few feet away from the court steps, not waiting on a decision. I was in a photo shoot. And so we hear this screaming. I mean, we just hear people erupt and start running. The few people who were of color, we started running away from the screaming. Because we were like, when they're screaming and a lot of white folks running, nothing good is going to happen. And finally, I am like past the Capitol, going across the street, and somebody finally, I hear people talking, and I finally understood. Oh my God, they passed it. So we turn around, of course, to go witness the celebration. But I always tell that story is just how far apart. We even my photographer started running towards the celebration because my photographer happened to be a white woman, But because for her, it didn't mean that. All I saw was white people running. And to this day, all I saw was white people running. And I remember my fear saying, I don't know what's going on, but it's white people running. And some of them have flags. I now realize they were rainbow flags. But I saw white people with flags. And I took off running in the opposite direction. So I think in all things, even in the progress we've made, we have to see it from the from the perspective that progress is made from. And I think that we all look at it through different lenses. And, you know, even with progress made, I still always just caution us to think of those people who are on the fringes in that. I still know so many people who are same-sex couples who cannot get married, not because the law will not allow them, just because other circumstances will not allow them. And I think we all need to always look at even our progress through our privilege.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. And not everybody shares the same group. I mean, that's a great point. But I really, really, really believe that I think the Obama Coalition was a great example. Like, when you have the right messaging, when you have the right, you know, a sort of broad coalition idea, you can make a lot of progress, right? And you can combat the negative messaging. I think those two campaigns were a great example of being able to combat negative messaging. And look, they were stifling everything he tried to do. Every single thing he tried to do, the Mitch McConnell thing, right? One-term president, we're not going to make any legislation. And still, they got through the Affordable Care Act. Still, you know, things happened. Why? Because people were on board with the Democratic messaging at the time.
Yeah, and just think of how much he could have get done if he didn't have to. As much as I hate to say it, he had to act a certain way.
I love him dearly, but I don't think he was a progressive. I think his agenda was really narrow.
I think he was pretty middle of the road. But I mean, let's face it, he couldn't get angry. All right, yeah. He really couldn't show any emotion because then he stereotyped, and
he wasn't already. Any emotion. I don't want to curse so many people out. I know you all think I curse a lot, and I do curse people out, but I want to curse so many more people out.
That's awesome.
And I cannot show emotion. I want to slap the shit out of a lot of people, and I cannot be an angry black woman because it's not about me so many times. It's about, you know, something that's bigger. I hate that cliche, it's bigger than me, but so many times it is. There have been so many times when I have to back off the ledge and say, I would curse this person out and slap the shit out of them. But for the one after me who didn't have as much privilege as me, but who looks like me, they won't get the pass that I'm going to get.
I mean, you look at whenever his State of the Union, whenever the one asshole senator called him a liar.
Yeah.
Right? I just screamed, you're lying. You know, and again, he couldn't get mad. He could. Can you imagine if he'd have done half the shit this asshole's done?
It would have been crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Just but because he's a black man.
But I remind us all to remember that this one we got in office has so much support. You know, this one that we have in office won an election. A lot of people in an ideal world, this guy would have had two votes.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Who voted for him. I'm embarrassed to say I have had friends try to, well, I don't know if I can call them friends anymore, but I have had associates try to explain to me why they voted for him.
Yeah.
Yep. And
we have to remember that a lot of people, this guy didn't just have, he still has a lot of support. I mean,
there was a shit ton of people at that rally in Hershey the other night. There was a shit ton of people there.
10,000, Patch. That's what the place holds.
My heart was broken a few weeks ago. This woman that I see all the time at a bar that I go to, we are whiskey drinkers. We love whiskey together. I've probably been drinking at this bar and seeing this woman for 6 months. She just, in the whiskey drinking the other day, told me how much she supports Trump. I fell off the damn bar stool almost. I mean, she would seem like the most rational woman that you would ever want to meet. So I don't think we can't let that get away, that he got in office for a reason, because he gave this message that so many people believe this impeachment being a witch hunt, and they'll soon adopt the word lynching. Shout out.
Oh, he already tried. No. He already tried. Was it him or Graham who already tried pulling that shit?
Yeah, they already pulled that, we must not forget that there are so many people that support it, and it's almost, I don't know, it's scary in one way, but in another way it's not, because those of us who are fighters and survivors will do what we've always done.
Survive.
We've always survived. We've always come up with a plan. You know, I think of the Montgomery boycott in December, where they said we will get a ride to work, but we will not get on this bus. Rioting is the language of the unheard. And so I think if we want to be heard, and I'm not saying riot, I'm not anybody listening to this, I'm not suggesting that we go out and, you know, riot. But I think until we take some true steps to show people that we care about things like the health of our country, rather than if Mike Vick can be on an All-Star or MVP, who gives a shit? He's redeemed. Who gives a shit?
So I think it's about getting out and voting and showing the power of the people. Everything is so gerrymandered. Everything is so mathematically improbable that, Boofoo, Ohio, with 649 people, had the same political clout as suburban Pittsburgh with 100,000 people. That to me is a travesty. But when you look at if you look at things from an actuarial type point of view, an actuarial science, that yes, that one and Master Patsy, this guy as well as I do, that one racist father who is going to instill his racist philosophy into his middle school educated son's head, who will propagate that to his children, does not equal the entire high school of students that are coming out that feel completely different. And so, the math is in our favor. Now, will it be in our lifetime? Maybe not. But as long as we continue the push forward and do things like at this next election, say, this is not right. A man who gropes women and brags about it, a man who abuses his power and authority is not right. And then the white men who support him, the Mitch McConnells and the Lindsey Grahams, need all to be thrown out people, it's the elections that count, and the masses can override. Look at South Carolina and Cunningham. You know, that guy was not given a chance, but I went to the polls and I stood in line for 2 hours with everyone else. All the people were there to vote him in, because we all knew that we couldn't have another, I forget who the Republican was, but some crazy white woman. Some privileged white woman who lived in a two-barrier enclave, because one gated community is not secure enough. You got to have two gates. He won because the people overrode the gerrymandering and all. And it was a sight to. I wasn't leaving that line, even though I was, work was screaming for me to get back. I wasn't leaving, and nobody else was either. We were all standing there because we knew our vote counted. And I sure hope that come this next election that people have that, that same intensity, that same desire to make their point known, and that we can get rid of these dirtbags and bring in some people that are more representative of the country as it is.
Well, Master Graham, we don't have a choice. I mean, we see what's going to happen if we don't. These clowns are there's no stopping them if we don't get out and vote and make our voices heard and draw a line in the sand. There's no stopping them then.
So here's the deal. The people who are the most vocal on sides, those are the people here. But 60 million people didn't vote.
Yeah.
So people like us, right? I mean, I'm talking to all the liberals of all sorts. We all need to find one non-voter and bring them with us. You know, yeah. One, not 100. You know, this isn't an activist moment per se, but it should be. But we all need to find some of these non-voters, these people who are so disillusioned that they don't think they matter, to speak to your point, Master Grant, and get out there on the line with at least one person who didn't vote in the last election and pray you're bringing somebody who's going to vote for our team. But
I think it's a nail on the head, though, with the disillusion. I mean, I think we have to realize, I know it's my soapbox, but even voting is a privilege. So even us having the time to research the issues and care is such a privilege.
Yes.
And so many people in this last, so I think people didn't vote in this last election for two reasons. As you said, disillusion, but also people thought that this, people did not think this election would go the way that it went, this last presidential election.
That's true.
But,
yeah,
but
I heard that a lot.
Yeah, a lot of people just did, they didn't like any candidate, but they thought that a certain candidate would win. But I think as you just brought up such a good point, the disillusioned are who really, because it is a privilege to vote for us. When I will admit that although the only thing that's really changed about my life with this presidency is that I'm up more watching TV and maybe my heart is a little more constricted sometimes. I'm having a few chest pains sometimes, but I did not have major changes in my income. I have not had major changes in my housing. I have not had major changes in my health care. I have not had major changes with my family. But it is the disillusion we have got. What can we say to somebody? What can we say to that person who, even though we have quote unquote Obamacare, who still can't get good health care? Why should they vote? You know, what can we say to that mother, that grandmother, who is just wondering if her babies are coming home at night? How can we say, yeah, take off of your job and go vote? Like, how can we? I didn't have to take off from a job to go vote. I own my job. I went when the hell I wanted to. But you know, how can we make people see? How can we make the person who's making minimum wage and trying to make ends meet see? Because everybody's the enemy to them. Everybody, and rightly so. Everybody is. How can we make them? What incentive? You know, I would love to walk down the street or call up people and say you should vote. But in my heart of hearts, I know why. Well, why? Actually, why should you vote? I mean, I know the answer to that, but why should they? And I think that's where the change lies, is that we have to give some incentive. You know, I'm talking about voting because as a business owner, I'm worried about taxes as a small business owner and what incentives. And as I'm getting older, about my health care. There's some people just trying to make it to tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's the key. How are we going to incentivize?
Give them a picture of Mitch McConnell and say, this is what happens when you don't vote.
Yeah.
You can give them a picture of Mitch McConnell. The picture of Mitch McConnell is no different from a picture of Frank to them. So, and that's not taking a hit. I mean, that's just being real. There is no difference. You know, I don't think so. There are so many people who, one, don't even know who Mitch McConnell is, and two, not even what he stands for. And so I think that, you know, that is going to be key, is give people incentive. Why should you vote? Like if somebody with no health care today asks me, well, why should I vote? You know, I was complaining about taxes the other day because, Lord, I owe a lot of them. I hope I'm with you all again, but it may be the end for me. But I was complaining about taxes, and my mother had to tell me, don't tell anybody else that that's your complaint, because what you're saying you owe in taxes, most people don't make in a year. And my mother is the number one privilege checker. She will check your privilege before you can open an eye in the morning. But I was like, wow, I'm up here doing all that, and the tax code is wrong and we need to do this. And she said, girl, what they want from you, somebody didn't even make last year or any year.
Right.
And that just brought it home for me. We need to have my mom on here to check everybody's privilege. But
you know what? And Yeah, Phil brings up a good point, Master Grant, because if you ever saw Frank on the floor, he kind of moves like a turtle. I'm sorry, Frank. I'm so sorry.
That was brilliant.
I have a whole show on misconceptions I had about Frank, but I'm like, who is this white dude telling me about his house in Italy? Hell, I don't have one in Africa. So who
is okay, so folks. Frank's staying muted.
I'm just letting y'all take your shots.
Frank, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. It's all right. My day will come one day when I'm on the floor with you.
I hope so.
We became very good friends when we went to a bar, and it was Frank's choice of bar, and the drinks were served out of red Solo cups. I was like, this dude is my best friend. Because.
Hey, that's Newcastle though. That's his upbringing right there.
Hey, I'm coming to visit because I'm drinking out of one right now.
Well, hell, you'll fit right in, believe me. That, you know, but that would be a more upscale bar.
Okay.
The red Solo cups are the upscale bars. It's usually the small little, you know, semi-transparent little water cups that we, you know.
Oh, well, that's the bar I want to go. Do you have to share is all I'm asking.
It's optional.
Okay.
Fellas, I think we're going to wrap this up. Oh, my God, was this awesome. This without a doubt, without a doubt, I can honestly say the best episode we've ever had. And I can't thank everybody enough for sharing this with us and being part of our you know, 1 year. Our celebration for 1 year of
the anniversary.
We are very speaking of privilege. I'm going to go out on a limb and speak for Frank a little bit and for Master Grant as well, as whenever I say we have some of the best people in the world here. We really do. And it is an absolute privilege to be able to share this with you. So thank you all very much for joining us. We absolutely want everybody back whenever you have time, and you want to jump on with myself and Frank, and even myself and Master Grant on Sunday if you'd rather, you know, do it on a Sunday, because I know sometimes Wednesday afternoons can be a little inconvenient. Give us a shout, let us know. I will be reaching out to everybody. I haven't talked to Dr. Dye in quite a while, which is unfortunate because, you know, we like to go back and forth a little bit. We're going to have to go out, Dye. We're going to have to make plans, maybe after the holidays, for all of us to get together.
I would love that. I'm sorry I've been away from. I own my job, too, because I gave up working for people I don't like. So I got a little tech company, and it is affected me. All this silly trade war is affecting me. So I would love to come back and talk. And Patsy, I'd love to go out. Let's do it.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll see if we can't get everybody together. We might have to fly Phil up. And, of course, we might not be able to afford first class for her, but, you know.
What about flying?
We'll do it on the weekend when Master Grant's up in PA anyhow. We'll just make a good night of it.
You know what? Just because I'm over here in London saying get Brexit done, and you guys ignore me, and you know, all right.
Okay, fellas, is there anything anybody wants to say before we throw this in the can?
Now, thank you for inviting us, though. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, we did too.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was. Believe me when I tell you, this was my best episode we've had yet. Absolutely my favorite. So like Frank and I say at the end of every podcast, like Master Grant and I say at the end of ours, to everybody listening, your time is very valuable, important, and the fact that you're willing to spend some of that time with us means a great deal to us. It truly does. It does truly mean a lot to us. So that being said, again, thank you to all of our guests today, and for everybody listening. We'll see you again next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. If you don't know what that means, you're too young to be listening to this podcast. But until then, to everybody, we say goodbye, good luck, and God bless.
You can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you.
Butchered Sports. Raw and unfiltered, the way you wish your local sports anchor would bring it to you. Find us on Twitter at Butchered Sports and on YouTube at Butchered Sports. Make sure to like, comment, and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to Holy Sh** with Frank and Master Patsy. If you like our show, please subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to support us on Patreon. Join us again next week when we discuss the next thing that made us say, Holy Sh**.